lovers. Welcome to Get Real, a podcast hosted by the National Animal Interest Alliance, through which we'll have deeply honest conversations about animal research so we can learn together and make compassionate choices about our medical future together. Welcome to episode 15 of Get Real. I'm Dr. Cindy Buckmaster, your host for Get Real, and I have a special treat for you today. It's the story of Cronut, an adorable, charismatic sea lion who, for me, has become an ambassador for everything that is good and loving in the world, as well as a powerful reminder of how truly connected we are to one another and our changing planet. Joining us today to share Cronut's story are Dr. Scott Barabin, professor and William K. Bowes, Jr. Endowed Chair in Neuroscience Research at the University of California, San Francisco, and Dr. Claire Simeone, marine mammal veterinarian, conservationist, and founder of Sea Change Health. There's a lot of love in this one. You want to share it with everyone you know. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Simeone and Barabin. I am thrilled to have you here to tell the story of Cronut the sea lion. Some of our listeners may have seen Cronut's story in the National Geographic, and it's been all over the news outlets, and it's just an amazing story. And I really feel very honored that you could take a few minutes to speak with us personally about this whole case, which is extraordinary, and everyone will find out why in a minute. Dr. Simeone, I think maybe we'll start with you, if you don't mind, because you're the person who has been working with Cronut all this time. You have had a career in marine mammal medicine as a veterinarian, and it would be great if you could give us a little bit of your background and how you got into this work and how that led you to Cronut, and then we can start talking about what happened with him.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, Cindy, and to tell Cronut's story. He's really had a big impact on me and my life and my work. So background about me, I'm a veterinarian, and I work primarily with marine mammals. And I previously worked with the Marine Mammal Center, and that's where I initially met Cronut. And then I've gotten a chance to work with him since he's been living at Six Flags Discovery Kingdom. And so, you know, seeing the effects of the toxins that we'll talk about with him and the effect that it's had on wild sea lions and just how challenging that's been to manage has been something that's really interested me over the past few years. And all of the things that came together have just been amazing to really help him and save his life.
Well, and he's so stinking cute. I can't even take it. I mean, it's just the cutest little thing. And, you know, in reading the stories about him, I mean, he had severe seizures. They started to get very, very frequent, you know, moving from one or two a month to several every week. Tremors, confusion, he couldn't eat. He dropped nearly a third of his body weight. I mean, it sounds like he went through a horrible, horrible time. And I know that our listeners may not know the story. And so this might be a great time for you to tell us sort of the general issue and what's happening to sea lions. And, you know, because Cronut's story is the story of many, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think it starts with looking at a toxin that's called domoic acid, that it's a toxin that is naturally produced by marine algae that live throughout the oceans, and they make up a whole bunch of the base of the food web. And the specific type of algae that produces domoic acid, they look like these tiny little cigars that kind of form chains. Pseudonychia is their name. And so naturally, they are found throughout the oceans, but they can form these large harmful algal blooms. And for those of you that live along the coast, wherever that coast may be, likely are familiar with some kind of harmful algal bloom, you know, whether that's red tides in Florida or these blooms that produce domoic acid. If you have listeners in the Bay Area, folks know that right around Christmas time is when Dungeness crab is fished. And it's this delicacy that a lot of people like to enjoy. But in past years, the fisheries has had to shut down because there have been high levels of domoic acid in the water. And so this toxin can have really far-reaching effects on health, but also economically, right? It's really impactful. And biotoxins, they're becoming more frequent. These blooms are becoming more frequent, more persistent. because we're seeing changes in our climate. We're seeing increases in sea surface temperature. You may remember back to 2015 when we had the blob on the west coast of the United States, and it was just this massive warm water that kind of sat along the coast from Alaska all the way down to Mexico. And it correlated to one of the largest and most persistent harmful algal blooms that had ever been recorded off the coast of the United States. And that has really far-reaching effects. So we'll talk about the effects on animals, but then it's important for us as well, because this toxin can cause amnesic shellfish poisoning in humans. So if you or I eat the toxin, then we can be affected similarly to the way that these sea lions do. So it's really important for us to understand for our own health, and then understand how it's changing in this rapidly changing world that we're living in.
Wow. Yeah. So what happened during the blob? Did you see a lot of sick marine mammals then as a consequence of all of the domoic acid?
Yeah, well, it was kind of a 1-2 punch. There were the effects of the domoic acid, and there were also the effects where sea lion moms had to travel farther offshore, dive deeper just to find food for their offspring, because this hot water was causing the fish to shift, and then they had to go. And so they were basically abandoning their pups. So you would see starving sea lion pups along the beaches, and then also really sick and seizing animals. When you have an active bloom of Pseudonychia, certain species of fish will eat the algae, they'll ingest it, and then they'll have a whole bunch of this toxin in their bodies. And then larger animals like sea lions will eat the fish, and then they'll have large amounts of toxin in their bodies. And so if you have animals during a harmful algal bloom that are eating a bunch of fish in this area, they'll strand or they'll beach themselves. They'll come onto shore and they'll be very sick. They'll be seizing. Some of them might be comatose, and it can certainly be a fatal disease. So a lot of the time, responders that are part of the marine mammal stranding network will try to rescue these animals, to bring them into rehabilitation, to try to do everything that we can to try to flush the toxin out of the body to hopefully avoid any permanent brain damage. A lot of animals, unfortunately, do die from this, even with treatment. What can happen is that they basically can develop seizures that don't stop. And at that point, we can make the decision that it's more humane to euthanize them if the seizures just don't stop, or if we suspect for another reason that they're not going to survive. Unfortunately, we don't have a specific antidote to the toxin, but it is water soluble. So if we can flush it out of the system with a lot of fluids and then control the seizures with anti-seizure medication, then hopefully you can help the animals that are the least affected. But unfortunately, that's not all of them.
Right. So Cronut was one of these sea lions who is stranded on the beach, and you've known Cronut since the first stranding. Is that right?
I wasn't involved in his initial care, but I was working with colleagues who were treating him. And so he was on my radar then back in 2017. And he stranded in San Luis Obispo, kind of central California. And he was a juvenile animal, and he was lethargic. He was kind of thin, but other than that, there wasn't a whole lot specific that was wrong with him. And veterinarians didn't see any seizures at that point. So he was released about a month or a couple of weeks after. And then he stranded again. And he seemed disoriented. He was also approaching people. And that's one of the things that is really challenging with some of the behavioral changes that come with being exposed to domoic acid, is that it can change the behavior of animals. And while it may seem cute or interesting that animals are not afraid of us, unfortunately, that's a really bad sign for a wild animal. You know, we want wild animals to be wary of humans. We want them to be living their life and not interfering with ours. So when he lost that fear and he was approaching people and everything, that was when veterinarians thought, you know, there may be something happening with exposure to domoic acid. And so he was released a second time, actually far out on the Farallon Islands, to try to give him a chance to just be with other sea lions and not around people. Then he came back again onto the beach. You know, at that point, he was actually coming up to people at public restroom on the beach, and he had lost weight. You know, it was clear that even though he had been out there in the wild, that he wasn't adequately able to care for himself, and his body condition was getting worse. And so he was deemed unable to survive on his own in the wild. And so at that point, National Marine Fisheries Service is the government agency that's responsible for animals that are along the coastline or that are in rehabilitation. They help to find a place where animals that are non-releasable can get the care that they need for the rest of their lives. And so at that point, he was placed at Six Flags in Vallejo, California, and he did start to have seizures. So it was a little bit clearer from then on what was likely happening.
So when he got to Six Flags, he obviously had a team of caregivers. And I mean, he's just such a sweet little guy. I imagine that they took right to him. You know, can you describe the relationship between Cronut and his caregivers?
Yeah, there is a really tight team of caregivers and actually a large team, you know, so Randy, Ashley, Stephanie, Talib, Caitlin, Aaron, Marissa, Clayton, Kate, Alex, Brooke, Kaylee, Eric, Diane, all of these people so committed to Cronut from the minute that he got there, as they are for all of the animals that they have. You know, he's maybe one of a dozen animals that this team might focus on. And it's clear that they become bonded to him, right? As all animal caregivers do. And it's funny to see, you know, Cronut, he definitely would have favorite humans. And so, you know, so like Clayton is currently his favorite human, but, you know, before that it was Stephanie and Ashley and Randy. And I'm sure it must hurt to like fall out of favor with Cronut, right? but he would be very focused on one of them in particular. And as a team, they were so meticulous in the records that they kept and the observations that they made, you know, and that was such a really key piece of tracking his disease and the progression of everything. Randy had such good attention to detail. So she started to notice small things, like he seemed to slowly shift his preference for eating towards the afternoon, something that you or I might not notice, you know, but instead of like ravenously eating right at 7 a.m., he'd sort of show a little bit of interest and then kick in around 8 and it would get a little bit later and later. And those minor changes actually ended up signaling that one of his episodes was coming on when he'd stop eating for a few days. So they had such great attention to detail for all of the small behavioral changes. And they kept in such close contact with us, you know, like Ashley kept really meticulous records. Like she would contact me at the beginning of every month and say, you know, okay, Cronut's records for the month are ready. You know, how has he been doing? Like, let's talk through it. And of course, everything is very professional and how they're communicating with me. You know, Talib would always like tell me that Cronut ate really well that day. But then, you know, I'd hear him calling him by his various nicknames, like Cronut the Donut or Crow or, you know. So it was really clear, just like they do have human animal bonds with any of the animals that they work with over long term for these non-releasable animals. It's really clear how much they care about him.
Yeah. So it sounds like they got really attached to him and he stayed relatively symptom free from these major seizure issues he was having, right? For quite a while. I mean, so how long was he there that they were all just kind of hanging out, you know, them and Cronut the Donut and having fun, right? How long before he started to show some serious signs of illness?
For about the first year to year and a half, he really remained pretty seizure free and just had a very occasional seizure and then, you know, went on his phenobarbital. But after about a year and a half, the seizures started to become more frequent and his behavioral changes started to become more dramatic as well. So he would go through these extended periods of time at some point in the summer of 2021, where he was going up to 16 days a month, you know, more than half the month, not eating anything at all. And so there was a period of time where things were well controlled. And then, as can happen with patients with epilepsy, it can progress and we lose control.
So presumably the acid is gone from his system at this point, but there's sort of this latent period, I imagine, and then later on the seizure disorder can kick in.
Yes, and that's been found in other sea lions and other species as well, where you can have the initial insult and then there can be this latent period where everything seems fine and then you can see epilepsy develop and brain damage, and that's what happened for Cronut. And then it just continued to kind of snowball on itself.
And so these people who were so in love with this animal then, and now they start to see him have some real serious issues. I mean, what did it look like for his caretakers when he would have these seizures? And I mean, what was their response to this?
Well, you know, seizures in sea lions look similar to, you know, seizures in dogs or even in us, in humans. And it depends on the type. But with Cronut, he would lose consciousness. So he would pass out and he would usually, you know, be on his side and then have the convulsions, his entire body. So, you know, his flippers would be flapping. And if any of your listeners have been around or had loved ones that have had seizures, it's very scary to witness. And there was one time when Pronut had a seizure when he was floating in the water, and they, you know, literally had to scoop him out. And I remember that Diane cried that day. You know, it was a dark day because we didn't know if he was going to survive.
My goodness. So how long did this go on?
Well, because his health fluctuated so much, you know, he would have these long bouts and then he would kind of come out of it and have a period of time where he gained a lot of his weight back. He would be seizure free for a couple of months. And so I think that was also really challenging because it's one thing to have a pretty continuous decline where things are just not getting better. But there were really periods of time where he would rally. And of course, you know, I sign up for the hard stuff, the emergencies and the disease, and that's my job. But, you know, I can't imagine that that's what Erin signed up for when she was sitting alone in the dark in the middle of the night, watching and waiting to see if Cronut, who she cared about so much, was going to have another seizure. And then to see that, and then like a week later, him, you know, seemingly bouncing back to normal, that's just so, so hard to live through.
At what point did you all finally realize, you know what, he's really got an issue now. We're going to have to do something.
When he really lost like a quarter of his body weight, you know, he lost 80 pounds at one point. And we were then, you know, having discussions about how much more is really something that we want to put him through. If this is just going to continue to happen and cycle, and, you know, to her credit, Diane, whatever Cronut needed, she made happen. You know, anytime he had a setback, she asked me, what can we do better? You know, what can we offer him? What's best for him? And so looking for other options was always in our mind, but then it was kind of always tempered with this reality of things slowly getting worse. And for me, having seen so many wild sea lions with this same disease and to see them seizing, become comatose, dying from it, it was very hard for me to kind of see that path as the most likely path of what was going to happen. And so I felt helpless as well. And I didn't want him to suffer. And so I really wished that there were more options available than what we had.
And so you had these conversations about, you know, his quality of life. And I imagine, based on the sound of things, that euthanasia was probably going to happen quickly.
Yeah, we were having conversations about at what point would we consider euthanasia and wanted to have a plan in place because that involves talking to government agencies, that involves talking to the entire team and being really clear about what would happen and when we would get to that point if we needed to. And so we were having those discussions.
And then along comes this wonderful scientist named Dr. Scott Barabin from UCSF, who's a lifelong career neurobiologist. And somehow you and he knew one another. Tell us the story about how that evolved and how you pulled him into the story of Cronut.
So Dr. Barabin had given a presentation about his work at the Marine Mammal Center, and he was already collaborating with my colleagues and had been having conversations with them. And so my husband, who's also a veterinarian and had been working at the center and working with Scott, said, "Oh my gosh, you have to call Scott. He's going to save the day." And he said, "You know, you guys are out of options, but talk to Scott and see where he is," because he knew that Scott had been working on this really groundbreaking research. And so he said, "You know, I'm not sure exactly where he is with it right now, but reach out to him, see if there might be a chance for this to help Cronut."
So Dr. Barabin, what was it exactly that you were giving lectures on at the Marine Mammal Center?
I had approached Dr. Francis Galland a couple years earlier to the Cronut story because we had been developing a interneuron-based cell therapy for treating intractable epilepsies that are focused in the hippocampus normally. And we had been planning to scale that up to larger animals before eventually, you know, maybe going to humans. So the project was developed in rodents. And basically, the simple explanation is we take cells from embryos that are destined to become a certain type of an inhibitory cell, and we're able to transplant those embryonic cells into the brain of another animal. And we found that over the years that they integrate and they increase inhibition, which is important in epilepsy, where there's usually a decrease in inhibition. And so that approach had scaled up to the point where we had already treated several rodent models, mostly in mice, with these cell transplants, and they were very effective. They basically cured the animals if we put the cells in after they had developed epilepsy. And so to get that to a larger species, we'd been planning and using pig embryos as a donor instead of mouse cells. And I had known for a very long time, because of work of my colleague Paul Buckmaster down at Stanford, that these domoic acid poisoned sea lions developed a form of epilepsy that was hippocampal specific and resembled temporal lobe epilepsy. So basically it mimicked the types of rodent models we had. And so as the pig project advanced, I approached the Marine Mammal Center to talk to Dr. Galland, who was running it, and say, hey, you know, this is what we've been doing. I showed her the papers and talked about it. I said, I think we can maybe do this for the sea lions. And so we worked with her. We talked with her a couple times. Then I think she asked me, if I remember correctly, to come down one morning and present to the group. And I think that's the seminar. It was really just an informal meeting where I presented what my lab did and kind of my hope that we can maybe scale this up for sea lions. And I'm guessing that's the meeting where Sean was in the room. And so that's probably that chance interaction of presenting that story before we had actually done anything to the staff at the Marine Mammal Center.
And this is before Cronut was even there.
So our plan initially was, you know, because we knew these sea lions were getting stranded and collected up by the Marine Mammal Centers and the rehab centers, that we would basically initially just kind of work on developing the surgical approach and transplanting the cells on animals already designated for euthanasia and then kind of optimizing that approach. And if it looked promising, then maybe we would try, you know, a live sea lion. We didn't know at the time, and we found out later, that OSHA, I guess, or the animal care people were not going to let us release a sea lion that we had transplanted with pig cells in its brain. And so we were kind of stuck in this mode of, well, maybe we do some acute treatments and watch the animals for a few months, but then that was the best we could do. At that time, I didn't know there were sea lions in captivity who had domoic acid poisoning.
So let's get back to Cronut. I mean, and it's the same with the others, right? So the domoic acid poisoning causes an issue in the animal's brain, in the hippocampus. And maybe for our listeners, you can describe exactly what was going on in Cronut's brain that was causing this horrific seizure disorder that he had. What was going on in his brain, and how would what you had been working out in mice help him, and why?
In general, when you have epilepsy, whether it's in people or in animals, it's kind of like an electrical storm. So you're going around normally, and then all of a sudden, you have this huge wave of electrical activity that's synchronized all at once. And that generates a seizure event, depending on what part of the brain it's in, you know, convulsive seizure event. Normally, in many types of epilepsies that are called acquired temporal lobe epilepsy, the damage is specific to one region called the hippocampus. The hippocampus, there's one on each side of our brains, controls a lot of memory functions and cognitive functions, and it's also kind of this relay point for where seizures usually originate. And so we know for many, many years that in patients, at least, they get damage to this part of their brain. It's very specific for certain cell types. And basically, you lose these inhibitory neurons that are putting a brake on this electrical activity. And so you can imagine when you have, you know, your brakes don't work as well, you're more likely to speed through and have a crash. And that's kind of what happens with patients with epilepsy as this damage increases. And so normally, there's only two treatments. One is to give a drug that maybe will boost this inhibitory system pharmacologically, and those are benzodiazepines usually, diazepam, things like that are commonly used. And sometimes in patients where if the damage is only one of their hippocampus on one side, neurosurgeons can go in and remove that hippocampus and hopefully get some measure of seizure control. So our approach, which is a little bit different, was to say, hey, we're going to leave this damaged hippocampus in place, but we're going to put back these inhibitory cells that have been lost. And so that was basically the project we've been developing here at UCSF for about 15, 16 years before the Cronut story. And the simple premise is that these inhibitory cells, if you could add more of them back, and if they can integrate in the circuit where you put them, they're going to increase inhibition in a natural fashion. And that will then, you know, restore the brakes on the system and prevent you from having these seizures. And so that's what we're hoping to do with Cronut, because it had worked very well in lower animals like in mice.
Amazing. So you develop some stem cells.
So stem cells involve taking a pluripotent cell at an early stage, either from human or whatever, and then deriving it in culture into the type of neuron you want. This is more of a cell transplant. This is a xenotransplant. We're taking actually embryonic or fetal tissue from an area of the brain where these cells are born. It's very specific. It's called the medial ganglionic eminence. And the types of inhibitory cells we want are born there, and then they migrate into our brain in various regions. So we basically harvest these cells freshly, and then we just transplant them into an animal, and they become what they're supposed to become. So this is not a stem cell approach. It's a cell transplant approach, but it uses fetal tissue. And it's most similar to work done in the 1980s in Parkinson's disease, where Kurt Fried's group had taken fetal dopaminergic tissue and put it into patients with Parkinson's disease. And he found some modest success with that. And most importantly, those cells actually didn't do anything damaging to those patients. And they survived for, I think, up to 21 years in those patients. So it mimics that more than what are called stem cell technologies, which try to derive the cells.
Yeah, thank you. That is an important clarification. And I'm not sure that came through in the media.
To be honest, it's a bit of a problem because they get lumped together. And there's a lot of commercial interest in trying to generate certain cell types, including these inhibitory cells. But the reality is that even though a lot of people have claimed this and companies have claimed this, there is no equivalent human stem cell line that makes the same types of inhibitory cells that these harvested MG cells make.
Well, that is a very interesting point, because we keep hearing from, you know, groups who are opposed to research with animals that, you know, the answer to everything is stem cells. And here you're saying very, very clearly that even though we have advanced in stem cell technologies, we haven't even advanced to the point where we could actually create cells from stem cells to do what it is we need them to do in the hippocampus and stop seizure activity. The only way to do that is to get fetal tissue that's already destined to do that, put it in there, let it integrate and do its thing. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. And a very important kind of distinction in that inhibitory cells, which we're talking about, these cells make GABA, which is an inhibitory transmitter, are very diverse. And so the problem with the stem cell technologies is how to make them into these very specific types of cells. Cells we use are maybe 30% of the types of inhibitory cells, 30 to 50%. And there are other types as well. And some of those actually would integrate and create the opposite condition, because those are cells that inhibit other inhibitory cells. It's a very fine distinction. And the stem cell technologies are fantastic, and they've come a long way, but they're not to the point where they can make these very specified cell types that we need, in this case for epilepsy and maybe other related disorders. And the second part is they also have to have an ability to migrate and integrate. And stem cells don't normally do that, but these progenitor cells, these cells we harvest, they maintain that ability. So those are two important distinctions. You have to have the right type of inhibitory cell, and they have to be able to migrate and integrate in the host brain after you transplant them. In this case, we used pig embryos. So we worked with the veterinarians at UC Davis as part of this collaboration to obtain pig embryos at the correct age where these cells are born and they're available. And work by Mariana Casalia, who is a very talented postdoc in my laboratory who drove this project during these years. She would go out to UC Davis and get these fresh pig embryos that were harvested from a sow that was destined for euthanasia at the correct age. And we had been characterizing them for several years before we had approached the sea lion people to make sure they were making the types of cells we needed. And so Marianne had done work in rodents to transplant these cells into rats to see if they look the same, to look at them in culture, and a variety of different techniques we have available in lab to show that these cells were identical to the mouse cells we've been working with that were therapeutic.
Right. I think that's an interesting thing to talk about just briefly, right? I mean, because I like to remind people that treatments like this don't just come from thin air, right? You said that you spent 15 years just doing basic science in this part of the brain, trying to figure out, you know, how things worked in there and what was going wrong and maybe how that could be fixed. And you came up with this idea of using these cultured progenitor cells. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the basic research involved, you know, what motivated you, what even made you think about this? What inspired you to start working on this puzzle, and that eventually then led you to Cronut?
I guess since the late 1990s, when I was a postdoctoral fellow and then my early professor years, I'd always been interested in studying the role of these inhibitory cells in the hippocampus and cortex and their role in epilepsy. So I had a long kind of background of knowing these cells were important both for controlling seizures and when they were defective for producing seizures. In early 2000s, I was approached by two colleagues here at UCSF, Arturo Alvarez-Bulla and John Rubinstein. And they had actually had two fascinating discoveries. John Rubinstein had discovered where in the embryo that these specific interneuron subtypes are born. Later, other groups added to this, but John was one of the earliest groups doing this. And he had found this medial ganglionic eminence region as a source of the types of inhibitory neurons that populated the hippocampus, the areas I was studying in the cortex. Arturo had separately found that if you harvest these progenitor cells and then you transplant them, that they would migrate in the host animal. And so they arrived in my office, I think sometime around 2001 or 2002, and sat down and showed me these pictures of cells they had transplanted that became inhibitory neurons. And I was pretty fascinated and, of course, interested because, like I said, I've been studying the role of these inhibitory neurons in epilepsy in the first place. And I said, yeah, I would love to find out if these cells can integrate and functionally, you know, improve inhibition. And if that's possible, which was the first couple years of looking at the project, I said, hey, I think we could actually develop this as a treatment for epilepsies because putting these cells in would actually stop potentially a patient from having epilepsy. And so I've been thinking about and working on that in the early 2000s through about, you know, 2008 or 9 when we started to test the first animal models. And it was very effective right off the bat when we transplanted these in animal models of epilepsy. And so we started to progress to look at various models, you know, different models representing different types of human epilepsies. And then I think when Mariana joined the lab, which was right after Bobby Hunt, who's now a professor at UC Irvine, had showed in a seminal study that we can cure mice that had temporal lobe epilepsy. She joined to take it to the next level, which was to see if we could progress this into larger animals, and took on the project of first looking at these pig MG cells. And then later, of course, she was integral to the Cronut story as well.
Yeah. So we're at the Cronut story. So now we have this poor animal. The vet and the caregivers, the team, they've been talking about, you know, maybe the only thing humane to do for Cronut now is to euthanize him. So now tell us what happened. So tell us how you found out about Cronut. Take us down that whole path, that part of the journey for Cronut. What happened? What were your expectations?
It was late in September. I received an email from Claire and Sean saying they had this sea lion, this rescued sea lion at Six Flags that was having severe epilepsy, a domoic acid sea lion, and that maybe I should see if I can come out and maybe develop a transplant technique for him, see if our procedure could work and test it on him. So I got up one morning, I drove out to meet everybody, and they brought out Cronut to show me. Of course, I'm not a veterinarian, I'm not a sea lion expert by any means, and so kind of fascinating to give a consult about an epileptic sea lion. It was really the first time I'd probably seen one in person. And I explained that, you know, yeah, we had this approach, we're pretty confident that the pig cells, you know, that we've been studying were good, that they were the types of cells we would need for therapy, that they were safe. And we weren't quite sure about some of the logistics of the surgery necessary because we hadn't tested that out yet, but we had an idea how we'd want to do it. And I basically, I think I told the group, I said, hey, you know, I don't know if I could save Cronut. I can promise you, worst case scenario, we'll put these cells in and nothing will happen. You know, we're not going to cause a tumor. We're not going to make his condition worse. I was pretty confident of that. But I said, you know, it might or might not work. If it does work, then it'll be pretty effective because when we've done this successfully in rodents, all the animals became basically seizure-free and improve their behavior. So I said, it potentially could be life-changing for him, but at the same time, there's also a possibility that it just doesn't work at all. So after the visit, I started, I guess, a series of separate email chains with different groups. There were three kind of logistical issues. One was my group specifically getting together to make sure we had pig cells available, and then getting the procedures and the techniques and the instruments that we would need on site. So we'd have to go on the road with my lab. So that was our side of it. A second group, fortuitously, was this collaborator I'd already had, Ben Inglis, who was at UC Berkeley, and he had been doing MRI imaging on domoic acid poisoned sea lions. So we'd been talking to him for a while, and he actually had a scan of Cronut from a couple years earlier. So we started to talk to the imaging team about what kind of MRI-guided surgery approach we would need. Laura Krasovic, who was here, helps my department on the clinical side, the neurosurgery side, from a company called Brain Lab. They kind of convened to see what type of images we would need to do this on site. A third group is I approached the neurosurgeons, my chair, Eddie Chang, and two of the residents in our program, John Andrews and Ryan, and asked them, you know, if they're available. We had a technique and approach. We just hadn't tried it first. And so they kind of had to work out adapting what we did in rodents to a larger animal, getting the frame and all the things necessary to deliver the cells. The fourth team, which was Claire and company, was finding a site to do this because this was during COVID. We had no mechanism to bring the animal to UCSF or to Berkeley. And so we had to find a remote site where we can get an MRI scan live, get all the people to that site of all these teams, get our lab to the site and the cells, and then be available equipment-wise with the vets necessary to anesthetize them and do all the other stuff to do this on site. And so that ended up being something Claire's group figured out at a clinic in Redwood City that agreed to let us do this on site.
Amazing. So you got all of these people, neurosurgeons and clinics and folks that are skilled in MRI guided surgical manipulations, and you got them all together for Cronut the sea lion. So when you brought this to people and you said, well, you know, we want to do this for Cronut the sea lion, did they look at you like you were crazy? I mean, what was their reaction?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't think here at UCSF and among my colleagues, I thought it was too crazy. It was a little bit surprising to me that everyone, you know, was available to basically volunteer their time and effort to come to this, you know, remote site on one morning with Cronut. You know, and it was time limited because we didn't have a lot of time to get this together. And we had the COVID restrictions, for example, of how many people can go inside the building and things like that at a time. And so I was pretty amazed that everyone was kind of like all in from the beginning, from the first emails.
Right. And, you know, and he was in a bad way. I mean, you're right. You did have a limited amount of time. And what do you think motivated them? Was it just the science, or was it helping this animal? What do you think it was?
I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, I think the people who knew the science, you know, were excited to see it kind of take the next step for the next level. And I think that the folks who cared for Cronut, the many people who love Cronut, wanted to see him do better. You know, want to see him have a chance to live and thrive. So I think it was really a combination of those two things. And, you know, it was really just asking for people to take a leap of faith with us. And that's kind of how I run my laboratory. And it was kind of expand that to this kind of real world problem where we had this sea lion that we thought we could treat, but we really needed to have the right people, the best people available to help us with it.
Amazing. And so Dr. Simeone, then your group must have been beside themselves, right? I mean, were they feeling hopeful or, you know, what was the vibe?
It was a little bit of disbelief. I think it, just like Scott had said, that everything was happening with COVID and all the restrictions around that, that I think each time point, each little hurdle that we got over was like, okay, we found a place. Or, you know, I think I kept expecting to run into some insurmountable hurdle because there were so many things to coordinate. And so I think every time we were like, okay, this next thing we checked off the list. Okay, this is happening. Everybody's coming together. And it was incredible to see 27 specialists come together with this. And the vibe, I think, around Krona several weeks prior to it was when he was really at his worst. And we were seeing a lot of issues. But then even Krona kind of rallied and the week up to it, because we were questioning whether or not he would, you know, actually make it through a procedure like this, just purely for like how sick he was. And then he really rallied and he even kicked in and was eating well that week and was a lot more stable. And so I think there was this hope that people were feeling like, okay, everything is coming together at exactly the right point, and we're going to go for it. We're going to be really hopeful that this is exactly what he needs.
So you do the treatment, and then what were the expectations?
First, I was hoping, you know, he'd go home and he'd recover from the ordeal of the surgery and being under anesthesia for so long. And so the first couple of days were just kind of hopeful that the procedure, you know, was minimally invasive like we thought it was. After that, the expectation was really to watch him month by month. The cells, because they're immature, you know, initially have to integrate and migrate. And in rodents, that took about a month to 2 months. So initially, I wasn't expecting much to happen. And then I was hoping by about 1 or 2 months in, we'd start to see some improvement in reducing his seizures. As the months progressed, I think my lab was hoping at the time we would get to Christmas with Krona being alive, because that was a couple of months in. When he made it to Christmas and a little bit beyond, we got hopeful that maybe this was going to work the way it did in mice, that it was actually going to suppress his seizures and improve his quality of life. And I think a couple of months into last year, early of 2022, when we got to 3 months post-transplant and 6 months post-transplant and he had no seizures and was starting to look better and starting to gain his weight back, then I started to believe, hey, you know, this might actually be working the same way we thought it would work.
Dr. Simeone, so he was seizure-free after this procedure and he seemed to be improving. I mean, what's everyone thinking?
Oh my gosh, they're so relieved and so excited that he's survived through the procedure, that things seem to be going well. Honestly, I'm not sure that they had a lot of downtime to sort of feel other emotions because it was such an intensive case. There were so many things in his post-op care that they were constantly monitoring, that they were constantly doing. Our entire team was doing that. And so I don't know that they got a chance to kind of like take it in immediately, but it's just so clear to see their joy as he reaches all of his different milestones. You know, Kate always says, like, every time I'm here, she's like, Cronut, Dr. Claire is here, your favorite person, you know, and like, I know that that is a gentle lie. Like the veterinarian is almost no animal's favorite person. But it feels really nice for me. and they're just great. They're like so effusively gleeful at every milestone that he makes. You know, oh, look at this new thing that he's learning how to do. He can show us the underside of his flipper, you know, so that we can look at it, so that we can check it out. And he would never do that before. And he's really interested in what we're doing. And, you know, oh, now he's in love with Clayton. And like, that's his new favorite person. It was so exciting to see that shift in how happy everybody was.
Yeah. Oh, they got their boy back. And he's such a sweet, sweet boy. And I can't even imagine how they feel about Dr. Barabin.
Oh, they love him. It is funny because even though he was not the neurosurgeon, like they still call him the neurosurgeon. Like his brain surgeon is here to to see Krona. And it's so fun to have him come out and see him and to just, you know, kind of show him off and for him to be like, look, he saved your life. This is so exciting.
It's just amazing. And of course, now the bigger question, you know, what about people?
Right. That's a great question. And I think it's certainly possible. Before this, we were making steps in that direction. We hadn't really considered what the plan would be to translate this from rodents to people. But Krona has kind of changed that plan substantially. So, of course, because of all the publicity he gets, many different clinician groups have reached out to me to see if we can kind of develop a protocol to do something similar in patients with human temporal lobe epilepsy. And so I've been in a number of different discussions to see what those steps would be to get from Krona to helping people. One of the big things, of course, is not just the efficacy, because we see that it's effective in rodents, and it's now effective in a feline, but safety. And so from my perspective, you know, having been, as you noted, patient on this, you know, for 15 or 20 years, I would also be patient before we did a human trial and want to see at least some additional safety data in a larger animal for at least a couple of years to make sure, you know, everything's good with these xenotransplants, because this would be a first of its kind in human if we do this. I think like Cronut, I'm optimistic about our science always. I think we're very scientifically rigorous. So when we get to those leaps of faith, I'm usually pretty optimistic that they're going to work. But there's also a huge safety issue. And so for me, that's the bigger concern with patients right now, is that we get some of that careful data in a larger animal for a couple of years at least to make sure there's no unanticipated side effects. Because again, with rodents, you know, they were short term. We didn't keep them for 5 or 6 years. And so we want to make sure that A, Cronut still does well, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, and that other animals, other large animals that we put these pig cells in don't have any negative side effects that we're not anticipating. But should that all happen, and it's all feasible from a scientific point of view, I think all these steps are possible, then it's just a matter of time to get these experiments done so we can then develop a protocol and approach patients with this potential treatment.
I mean, definitely the safety stuff has to be done, absolutely, and the FDA will require it as well. So which large animal, which would be the optimal species for you to do this work in preclinically before, you know, you could consider entering clinical trials with people?
Ideally, a non-human primate that was in an academic setting, so we can do cognitive testing, you know, imaging, a variety of wide-scale assessments that the cells were safe.
Well, that makes perfect sense, right? Because of all the behavioral things. So, you know, this is why they're so valuable in any kind of research related to cognition, right? Well, I have one final question for both of you. Do you have any final comments, anything else you want to share about how this scientific achievement has affected you and your hope for the future?
So the biggest effect, I think, which I guess was unanticipated, was things like this, podcasts and news articles and social media following of Cronut's story. I think this has been a great way for the public in general, and even more my colleagues, to hear about what we're doing beyond the narrow kind of academic circles where I would normally talk about our research. And so it's been a fascinating career event in that, you know, we've worked on this, or I've worked here at UCSF for 23 years. And I'm finding, even among my colleagues here at UCSF, the Cronut story is so popular, some people think that's the only thing I've done. And I find that fascinating in a positive way, that this kind of story really highlights the type of science we do. And so I'm really glad to see that happen. I'm happy for Cronut, obviously, and I'm happy that people hear about his story, both within the universities as well as in the lay public. It drives us to do even more things like this, and it's very motivating. And also, of course, rewarding to, you know, see that people recognize what we've been doing in this case, the form of Cronut.
Right. It is fascinating. And Dr. Simeone, how has this scientific achievement affected you and your hope for the future?
You know the feeling when it's just sort of like magic, everything comes together and like something gets knocked out of the park. To see that happen and the result of so many people's long-term work to hit that out of the park, and then to see it actually save an animal's life, is that feeling of knocking it out of the park and like watching that ball go as far as you can see. So it has been such a cool feeling. And for me, my focus of my work and my career has been to help to translate the importance of animal health, like marine mammal health, and then what that tells us about the health of our ocean and what that tells us about our own health. The Cronut story is the perfect story for that. And so that really gives me hope for the future, because we need everybody doing what they're best at and solving problems. And even if it's not even knowing what the end result is going to be, we just need everybody engaged like that to tackle these huge issues, things that seem like they're totally overwhelming, like climate change and sea level rise and biotoxins like domoic acid, because we're in a race against time. And so to see an example of that gives me hope that we can all come together and solve these really big problems, because we need to.
Yeah, that's great. Do either of you have anything else you want to share with our listeners before we close?
The only thing that I wanted to follow up, because I think it was so funny, about Scott saying that, you know, some people think that Cronut's like the only thing he's ever done, which just made me laugh out loud because of how accomplished he is and everything. And so one time I had just flown back into SFO and I drove past this billboard that said something like UCSF neurosurgery, number one in the country. And I was like, for humans and for sea lions, you know, like that should totally be added to the billboard. No one knows.
For people and sea lions. I love that. And I love this story because Dr. Simeone is right. Cronut wouldn't be here if Dr. Barabin and his team didn't do what they were best at. And he wouldn't be here if Dr. Simeone and her veterinary team didn't do what they were best at. He wouldn't be here if the neurosurgeons, imaging specialists, and other clinicians involved didn't do what they were best at. And he definitely wouldn't be here if his team of highly trained caregivers who love him so much didn't do what they were best at. Real change, real breakthroughs don't happen overnight. They emerge from years and years and years of perseverance and passion in people who never stop doing what they're best at. I'm Dr. Cindy Buckmaster, your host for Get Real, and I hope you enjoyed Cronut's story as much as I did. You absolutely must visit our episode response page to learn more and see how stinking cute he really is. It's too much. You'll find the link in the lower right-hand corner of our website at getrealpodcast.info. And don't forget to visit our support link to make a small monthly donation to help us keep rolling. Your commitment to me will help me keep my commitment to you. You know, doing what we're best at often requires that we know when it's time to up our game. Find out what I mean on the next episode of Get Real. We'll talk soon.